Well, first of all, thank you very much to Mark Bailey for hosting that last panel. That was a very interesting discussion. Now, the clue is in the heading, Managing System Liquidity Risk. That's what we're about to speak to. Scott gave quite a few, a bit of a good, you know, setting for this session in his opening remarks. I'll just go through a little bit of a scene setter, quick run through of who is on the panel, and then we'll go through some questions and explore the subject. Scott obviously mentioned that the growth in superannuation in this country has been very substantial, and clearly the numbers are very large, and getting larger, and it won't be long before at least the superannuation assets exceed those of the banking sector. Liquidity has been something that Australia has thought about in a formalised way over many, many years. In more recent times, it's we as a country and authorities and so on are turning their minds to understanding just how banks and superannuation interact, I guess, through the concept of a liquidity event and understand what that looks like in more detail. We are delighted to have on our panel today Brad Jones, Assistant Governor from the RBA. Next to Brad is Claire Thornton, Head of Treasury at Australian Super. Michael Claven is next in along the line, Head of Income and Markets at Aware Super. And on the end there, Joanne Dawson, the Group Treasurer of Westpac. Thank you so much. And I think Brad, if we can start with you and talk about it's nothing new that the RBA and others are looking at liquidity. So maybe you can get a start by what are the growing areas of focus in the RBA's monitoring of liquidity risk in the Australian financial system, please.
Just to sort of high-level conceptual framing, I would say that our main area of focus is we're considering spending a lot of time considering how the next war could be different from the last. That's really the high-level conceptual framing that's driving a lot of our work. If I were to very crudely summarise, the solution to nearly every potential problem in the Australian financial system for the last three or four decades was simply to ask banks to hold more capital, more liquidity, and that was it. That sort of focus is no longer sufficient. And there's really two key changes that are driving this. One is the structure of the financial system is evolving in really profound ways. And second of all, the nature of the risks that are barreling down at us, particularly from offshore, intense technological disruption, intense geopolitical disruption. There's a couple of examples. Basically mean that our approach to thinking about liquidity risk, systemic liquidity risk, has to be a lot more expansive than it has been historically. At a more concrete level, we're stepping up our analytical and operational focus on systemic liquidity risk in a couple of dimensions. The first is our work relating to disruptions that could affect the functioning of core financial markets, our core funding and hedging markets that are critical to the economy. Our sense is the most likely source of disruption is in the global bond market, but that's one piece of work. And separately, disruptions to institutions that basically move money through the pipes of the Australian financial system. It's not just about banks. It includes financial market infrastructures, super funds, key entities involved in payments, and so on. So the sorts of scenarios that we and APRA, our colleagues at APRA, have in mind now are much more expansive than they were historically.
Yes, there's plenty to think about. And maybe staying with you, Brad, if you've recently talked about, a new area, new era of where op risk and liquidity risk could interact in ways we've not seen before. Maybe you can expand on that for us all, please.
Yeah, this is the interaction between operational risk and liquidity risk is one example of how we think the future is going to be different from the past. And this is also partly reflected, I should say, in APRA, in APRA's recent focus on operational risk through CPS 230 and others. I think it's probably fair to say that in times past, operational risk was considered to have very little, if any, connection to core financial risk. It was sort of this bucket of risk that kind of sat over on the side. But as critical services are increasingly digitalized and interconnected, as we saw overnight with AWS, third-party providers now are really key. We can see at least two channels through which operational risk and liquidity risk could interact in disruptive ways. Mm-hmm. The first would be through confidence effects, where, for instance, you could see a massive cyber attack or other operational disruption that basically undermines confidence in that particular institution and could potentially set off a digital run. A second channel would be where a major operational disruption, it could be a foreign adversary attempting to disrupt our payment system, or it could be a massive settlement failure at a key FMI, disrupted the flow of money through the pipes of the system. So they're the two mechanisms. We did see in April what we think is probably a window into our future there, when a wave of credential stuffing attacks were launched at super funds right at the same time that we saw a significant pickup in financial market volatility around the time of the US tariff announcements. That to us is a bit of a shot across the bow, and you know, we're certainly leaning into that. But I'll just finish off by saying, I haven't mentioned AI yet, mm-hmm. and I haven't mentioned quantum yet. Mm. Quantum's coming for us, and so the bank, we're doing a lot of work, including with industry, to make sure that we have a financial system here that is quantum ready.
Okay, thank you for that. And just for, I guess, edification of the group in the room here today, I think about half the attendees would be from the industry super space, something like that, and lots of banks, lawyers and so on. Liquidity's been around for a long time, you know, APS 210 banks and so on. SPS 220 has been around for a while, where liquidity gets mentioned in the superannuation framework, but maybe now going to you, Claire, from an AusSuper perspective. So staying with liquidity for now, a double barrel question. As a very large super fund, how do you view liquidity management now, and how do you see it evolving in the future? And the second part is, to what extent do derivatives provide part of that management, please?
Yeah, so I've been at AussSuper for 10 years and specifically looking at treasury and liquidity risks for the last five. So I might talk a bit briefly about what's changed over that time, as well as what I think might be coming in the future. So a few things have changed, and I think the audience has probably heard about a few of these already this morning. One is clearly the size of the fund and the system. What that means from a liquidity risk perspective is that while the fund has always had an interest in ensuring that the way that we interact with markets is done with members' best financial interests, so we want to be interacting with markets in a coordinated and thoughtful manner, as we get bigger, that becomes a bigger challenge. And so, you know, more and more effort is put into making sure that the way that we think about provisioning for liquidity events is cognizant of the ongoing market impact that might come from our activity. Mm-hmm. It also, I think, in future means that super funds are going to need more tools in their toolkit to deal with a liquidity event, whether it's driven by member activity or driven by market activity. So, you know, being restricted to selling assets is probably not always the best way to manage a liquidity event. And thinking about the way in which we collateralise, the assets that we can use for collateralised, and being a bit more sophisticated about that is clearly going to be part of the future for the super industry, from what I would say. The other thing that's changed is that as members have accumulated more balances, so if I think back 10 years ago, the fund was growing like exponentially and inflows were huge compared to the size of the pool. Australian Super is still cash flow positive, still expects to be cash flow positive for at least another decade. But as a proportion relative to the size of the assets that we're managing, that's declining. Members are also starting to accumulate good balances, so they're becoming a bit more engaged. So 10 years ago, I think the average member didn't even know who their money was with. certainly wasn't engaged in electing an investment choice or moving. We're starting to see members appropriately become more engaged as they start to accumulate more balances, and you know, at a really high level, that's a great thing, but it does create additional challenges for us when we manage the investment portfolio. Mm. And what will be important for us as we start to see the demographics move is to have a really good understanding of what are some early warning indicators for particularly older members that have the option to take lump sum withdrawals or change their pension allocation. So it's not a pressing issue, but it is something that over the next decade or 15 years, I think super funds will have to get a better handle on what are the potential drivers for member behaviour. Mm. And then the third thing that's changed over the last decade is, for us anyway, is our use of derivatives. Mm. So as the fund's grown, we've obviously needed to do more hedging activity. We've used more derivatives. It's a key part of the way that we manage our investment portfolio. It's worth noting that there are, I think, two related but distinct conversations around derivative use that often can get a bit confused when we talk about liquidity risk. So, you know, the first sort of part of liquidity risk for a fund is like the actual funding need. So can I fund a member's pension? Can I fund a margin call? External flows. The second piece, and where we use derivatives most, is in managing our market risk. So have we got enough liquidity on the balance sheet to rebalance the portfolio to the desired asset allocation that the fund wants to hold at any point in time? And that's where derivatives are useful for us. They're in deep liquid markets. We can access the beta, and it helps us to get to our desired market risk positioning when physical markets are difficult or expensive to access. And sometimes those two concepts sort of spoken about concurrently, but they are distinct. They're related, but they're distinct. So, you know, derivative use is pretty critical for the fund in managing its market risk. There is a feedback loop. Obviously, the more derivatives we hold, the more margins we need to provision for. But it's a key tool for us, and will be going forward.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back to you, Michael, on a different question. I guess, Joe, if we can go to you from a Westpac, so major bank perspective, I guess there's almost like a compare and contrast sort of question. So as a treasurer of a large bank, obviously we've seen things like SVB, we've seen funds move quickly. Modelling of this type has been done for at least 25 years in a formal, prudential way. So as a treasurer of a large bank, how do you consider liquidity, and how fast could a run on a bank occur these days, please?
Yeah, so a couple of things just to mention there, and just to pick up on a couple of comments that Claire said. So I think from a bank perspective, certainly we are very mature in terms of liquidity risk management, and liquidity risk management frameworks have been around well before the LCR. And as you point out, Brett, we've been considering liquidity well before then, and things like quality of deposits and stability of deposits, maturity mismatch, maturity profile have been considerations even before the LCR came into play. I think in 2015 when we got the LCR, that changed things, and there has been quite a big development in liquidity since then. I think what that did was it really moved liquidity into the broader bank, and it gave a framework really for our business and our operating division to evaluate liquidity of deposits and some of the products that they have. So I think that was a big development at that point in time, and really took it out of Treasury and into the broader business. I think another lens you can sort of think about from a development perspective is obviously from a HQLA perspective. So when we actually implemented LCR back in 2015, we were holding around $123 billion of HQLA assets. We had a CLF as well, and we were running an LCR of 114%. If you sort of go forward to where we are today, a decade later, we're over $180 billion of HQLA assets and an LCR of in our third quarter of 134%. So things really developed over that time. I think the other thing, and just to touch on your point around Silicon Valley Bank, which, you know, albeit was excluded from the US LCR regulation, from our perspective, we use things that we see in the external environment to consider when we think about things like stress testing. And stress testing, to Brad's point earlier, has evolved quite considerably over the last decade. We have much more sophisticated stress testing than we had and we've developed it over that period. But we do use a lot of information that we get from the market. You know, I think you're right in terms of the Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah, a bank run doesn't look like people, you know, lined up around the corner anymore. It's a different, it can look very different to that. And I think that one of the things that we got out of the Silicon Valley Bank experience was that the quality of deposits, the granularity and diversification of deposits is very important. And I think that, you know, if you look at our balance sheet and how we've been growing over the last few years, that has, we've continued to grow our high quality, stable deposits over that time. And I think then, those learnings, those considerations in terms of how the world continues to develop will continue to apply across our stress tests and how we think about the broader liquidity across our portfolio.
Okay, thank you for that. So now turning to you, Michael, from Aware Super, and I guess picking up some of those comments and also Claire's comments. So super funds, as we all know, have the comfortable position of a legislated, you know, regular inflow of cash. But there's going to be a point in the future where the decumulation flows become material and maybe lead to the balances reducing. It'll happen at some point, I guess. Is that something that keeps you up at night? Is it something that we should be preparing for?
Well, I don't think it would keep me up at night. I mean, I think it is the nature of the system and the demographic that we will come to a point of deaccumulation. You know, I think when you look at the industry as a whole, there are a lot of funds that are already in that scenario. Actually, the vast majority of the funds are actually in that scenario. And I think that's also accelerated. You know, as Claire talked about member balances growing, we find that that's meant more money is going to other avenues within the superannuation system, platforms, self-managed super funds, which again, I think has tipped more funds into a negative cash flow position.
Mm-hmm.
I think as an industry, we need to focus on that, but I think it's really about focusing on serving the members that are in the retirement phase better, making sure that we have competitive products and offerings to service the needs of those members is probably what I would say is keeps me up more than the actual liquidity risk or the risk of a deaccumulation in the system. I mean, I guess what I would also reflect on, you know, looking at Brad's comments, which I mean, paints a very challenging future, and particularly from external shocks. But I think, you know, reflecting what a great position Australia is in to manage that with this really large savings pool that most countries would be very happy to have. And I think that if done appropriately and managed through the right tools, can help absorb some of those risks that Brad talked about. But I think those risks are real, but I think Australia is in a great position with the amount of savings that is in the system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a terrific, I'm not sure what the word is. It's not a problem. It's something that's great.
Yeah.
We all like this situation, and to your point, it's all about understanding the interdependencies and what it might look like in certain events. Maybe we can switch across now to the investment side of the super fund business, and staying with you, Michael, please. As we know, and I think Scott also mentioned this morning, with an increasing amount of money from the funds being invested offshore, in that context, I mean, that percentage is growing, the numbers are getting bigger. What role do you see hedging and derivatives playing in your investment and management decisions, please?
Yep. So, You know, I think there's a couple forces going on about the composition of assets between domestic and international. Some of them are, you know, just by the sheer size of the system, but I think it's actually the dynamics within that system that are changing as well. You still have an industry that is consolidating and tends to be consolidating into larger funds. Those larger funds are hitting capacity constraints within Australia where to invest, which means more of their investment dollars are going offshore. I think that also then manifests itself in the last decade of perceived American exceptionalism, which meant the Aussie dollar hedge to the US dollar has grown considerably as more of those dollars going offshore are actually going into dollar assets by the composition of the index in which we invest. So I think you're seeing the rightful conversation around how is this sustainable in the future? And my view is you have to have that conversation with derivatives and looking at the way in which you manage currency risk within your portfolio, and derivatives are a key part to that. And I think it has to go beyond just the typical forwards. I think you really need to look at what the risk is that you're willing to take in regards to FX within your product set and manage that through several different tools. Derivatives, though, I think would be a key plank on how you manage that risk going forward. To echo Claire's point as well, I think when we look at a liquidity event within Aware Super, the biggest drawdown on liquidity is actually managing investment risk.
Yes.
And that is the shortest time frame in which liquidity is drained from the fund. So if I look at, let's say, FX liabilities or margins can be quite close too, but a lot of those liabilities can be sort of spread out over a certain amount of time, but managing the fund's investment risk is the typical drawdown, and to me, derivatives are actually absolutely key to manage that part of the liquidity.
Yeah, understood, thank you. And now maybe back to Claire and to pick up the comment around FX derivatives and just derivatives in general. I mean, obviously the industry funds are investing offshore. The hedging that's done will be the same, if you like, across, you know, funds doing that. So there'll be a substantial position where everybody has that same exposure. So do you see overall, though, increasing use of FX and other derivatives, interest rate swaps and total return swaps and so on?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say we're all exactly the same, but I understand we're all on the same side. Yeah?
Yes.
So I don't want to say that every fund's making exactly the same hedging decisions.
Yeah. The natural position.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think, so I might end up repeating a bit of what Michael said here, but the decision around how much foreign currency risk to hold in a portfolio is a trade-off, right? It's a trade-off of your portfolio construction decision, how much you're investing offshore versus domestically, your total risk of your portfolio, the relative risk of the portfolio, potential liquidity implications, and counterparty capacity. And to date, when we think about those trade-offs, we haven't found them to be in direct conflict. We recognise that it's likely that as the system grows, as we've heard, it's going to grow, with compulsory inflows. It is likely that there will be more tension between those trade-offs at the future. Now, I don't know what the answer is in terms of whether funds change the amount that they hedge or whether we find ways to deal with the liquidity risk, but I think it's very likely that as the system grows, super funds will need to use derivatives proportionally with that growth.
And maybe a question to you and Michael, do you see any challenges, if you like, in terms of the way, I guess, derivatives are done currently in terms of absorbing, extra need for derivatives in terms of the infrastructure, I guess?
I don't know about the infrastructure. There is certainly what we're certainly becoming aware of and talking to our counterparties about is how global banking regulations around their capital and liquidity requirements mm-hmm. are affecting their ability mm-hmm. to support our activity and what that path looks like over 5-10 years. And working with our counterparties to ensure that we're arriving at solutions together that allow us to continue to access FX markets. I think it, from a domestic sort of financial stability point of view, it's important to recognise that a large Aussie dollar fall is it's not an event that we haven't seen before. Like it's a pretty typical event that super funds have both seen before and managed through mm-hmm. before. And I would be, it's certainly part of our regular stress testing and our provisioning and our liquidity ratios. And I would be mm-hmm. willing to bet that it is on for most major funds. So it's not something that is new or particularly frightening from that point of view. And the other thing to note is that when we do see that event, because we're not fully hedging our international investments, we do have a tendency to be in a position at the end of that event or during that event where we're overweight fairly liquid international assets and have a tendency to want to rebalance that back to domestic assets. So, you know, there's nuance in the timing of all of these decisions, but... Yeah. Oh, sorry, Michael, I talked for a long time.
No, that's all right. Look, I think one of the things to consider in the system is, or individuals within operating that system is, I would agree, I think derivatives are going to grow exponentially with the funds. But I think as a practitioner of implementing strategies through derivatives, I think we have to, part of our fiduciary responsibility is making sure we have the right systems, the right governance, the right risk oversight to manage those positions to actually make sure that they are increasing the stability of the system. Mm. And I think that takes, an upskilling in internal teams. It takes an upskilling in your systems. And managing, Claire does, is like a treasury function, is managing your balance sheet, managing your collateral to make sure that you're optimizing your liquidity using these instruments. Because I think if you go down this route not fully understanding the implications of mm-hmm. the positive liquidity implications that derivatives can have, but you need to understand the operational risk. Yes. You need to understand the liquidity draws and how you manage that. And I think that's an uplift in internal.
Thank you. And I guess all the talk about FX is a perfect point to come back to Brad. As the guardian of the Australian dollar, the implications, you're able to comment on the implications for FX market from the growth in super funds and their use of FX derivatives. The numbers there are very large.
Yeah, the first point to make for a bit of context, these are extremely deep markets. Okay, the Aussie is the sixth most actively traded market in the world. Swap volumes exceed those in the spot market. We haven't seen a need to intervene in the foreign exchange market since 2008. So that mm-hmm. the context matters there. Mm-hmm. Our current assessment is we do not see systemic issues today. COVID, I think as Claire was intimating, COVID was a live stress test. Industry got through that period in reasonable shape, though I'd add in part because many super funds didn't have mm-hmm. to post margin on FX hedges. We've also observed a big uplift in the management of FX and liquidity risk across the super fund industry since that time. I think Michael was alluding to that. I think in times past, a lot of funds basically just roll 1 month forwards. The suite of strategies that are now being employed, a lot more sophisticated. All of that said, there's a but coming, and this is the but. It would be, we think, a dereliction of our duty not to be thinking about how that relatively benign current conjunctural environment could evolve in the future. And to that, I would say three things. First of all, the growth in foreign exposure, asset exposure for this industry and the foreign currency implications of that are going to be very material vis-a-vis, say, the volume of bank offshore funding that's being swapped back into Aussie heading in the other direction. So there's some interesting potential implications over the long term for supply-demand imbalance there. The second thing is we also know, because of the demographic profile, that there will be a relatively larger share of fixed income holdings from our super fund industry over time. And the hedge ratio on foreign fixed income tends to be across the entirety of the industry, about three times higher than for equities. Differs across individual funds, but that's at the aggregate level. So there'll be more hedging-related demand from that evolution. And the third change is that margining and collateral requirements will also increase over time, not just because the gross numbers are going up, but also because of counterparty limits. And it's quite reasonable to expect that foreign banks, standing on the other side of some of this activity, might be inclined to offer less favourable terms than some of our domestic banks. So there's a few reasons as to why that system or those forces could change over the next 5-10 years.
Okay, thank you for that. A nice easy one for Joe to bring you back into the conversation. If a serious liquidity event did occur, do you think the super sector would help or hinder, or is it too early to say in terms of, I guess, the interplay between super and banking?
Yeah, so a couple of things just to mention on this. I think it's really important that we understand the important role that both super and super funds and the banks play in terms of the overall economy and the financial system. And I think that's really important to understand. I think that the other thing to consider from an Australian perspective is that these are relatively simple organisations on a when you think about this in a global context. We're also well regulated and well supervised. So I think that they're really important sort of foundations in terms of how we think about this. There are obviously, as we think through this, and we've given this a lot of thought over the last few years, there are interdependencies and there are obviously interconnectivity between the banks and the super funds, and we're very conscious of that. And I think that certainly in terms of some of the last stress testing that we undertook that APRA ran, I think that is a very good exercise to identify some of those interconnectivities and also where there are needs from an overall regulatory perspective to consider some of those risks. So I think that's been a good exercise. We await the outcomes of that to see what the findings are. The other thing I'd say is, though, and I sort of touched on this in the first comments, though, the banks are very mature in terms of our liquidity and liquidity risk management frameworks. I think that the super funds have come a long way, and certainly we've heard that that today. But I think that there is, so I think we're on a journey here. But I do think that just going back to the point that we can take some comfort from the fact that we have we have that simplicity, but we also have strength in our overall system. And I think that, as Brad pointed out, COVID was an example of that, where it was a live stress test, and we saw the outcomes of that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I guess let's all reflect on the heading on the slide there. I know, Brad, you made a couple of comments already, and I'll ask others to put their views in as well. I guess the key question is, how prepared are we for a systemic liquidity event, and what more do we think at this point in time we need to do as an industry? We start maybe with Brad, I'm happy to go down the rest of the line, please.
APRA have recently undertaken a system-wide stress test with their regulated entity, so I don't want to preempt what they might say. What I can say, though, is the starting position is certainly one of strength. Our larger banks have significant holdings of liquid assets. Our medium to smaller sized banks are thinking harder, not just about the size, but the composition of their assets, making sure that they can raise liquidity, including through repoing them rather than dumping them out in the open market, which we think is important. I mentioned before, super funds are increasing the sophistication of their liquidity risk management our FMIs and payment system are thinking harder about big liquidity disruptions. So all of that, as Joe alluded to, is, I think, cause for some comfort. That said, we all know through lived experience, if there is a systemic shock, particularly one coming from abroad, our financial system won't be immune. And so we are doing a lot of work across multiple domains to harden the system and prepare the system to be able to withstand very significant disruptions. What we are, where our mind is turning most acutely, is to a number of shocks occurring simultaneously. We're not just thinking about isolated shocks, we're thinking about a number of shocks coalescing. And so with that in mind, if I can offer some free advice, use stress tests, reverse stress tests very creatively. I don't think that assuming the past will repeat is a great guide, given my opening remarks. And we would really encourage industry to challenge their core assumptions and make sure that those are robust, because that's really the starting point for these sorts of exercises. So we're in a good place, but it's there's absolutely no a reason for complacency.
Yes. Okay, thank you for that. I remember in my former life, sitting in a room with somebody talking about the, you know, the Enron going bust as a stress event, and people arguing, well, that would never happen. And of course it did. I guess we just very quickly get some other comments on the same question just down the panel. So, you know, how prepared are we, and what more do you think we need to do? I guess there's a very positive message I think we are trying to get across here, that this is a subject and an issue that a lot of smart people are thinking about, and that when people go to do their jobs inside industry funds, you may not have an APS 210, but that doesn't mean you're not thinking about liquidity and you're not living it every day and sweating the detail. So, but having said all that, how do you feel in terms of, I guess, preparedness for an event from the industry super side? Happy for Michael or Claire to go first.
Well, I'm next in line. Yeah. So I would sort of agree with Brad's comments. We're starting from a position of some strength. Mm. If I reflect on my time, I feel considerably more prepared now than if I'd been faced with this challenge 10 years ago. And prepared not just from an investment portfolio or treasury perspective, but also, you know, across the fund, the increasing awareness about what would be required from a comms perspective, and across other domains in the business as well, in response to a liquidity event, is really starting to uplift. What more do we need to do? Like, I agree completely with Brad. This intersection of multiple events, and we saw a bit of a taste of that in April, is a key thing. And so really thinking about how, as a broader, you know, what partners do we, as a financially sort of significant and important institution, what partners do we need to have across the spectrum of the financial markets to ensure that we can manage through an event is an area that we're focused on.
Thank you. And Michael, have you got something to add to that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. We're in a very good position now. I also agree. I think we need to be thinking about the future. I think we need to think about the size of the system and how we look at our role in the capital markets to ensure that we are a force of stability. And I think having that conversation now rather than at the time of a crisis is very well warranted, because I think there are things that we can look at doing domestically in how the super funds operate, how the capital markets operate, to at least help with the next crisis. Because I agree, I think trying to roadmap it based on past events is in difficult. I guess I would like also in that conversation, you know, talks about what preservation means, and other things that have been moved into the conversation during crises and how we manage that as an industry and as a system.
Okay. Thank you. And finally, Joe, any reflections on this? Obviously, you've got a strong view on your own bank's position, but from a system perspective.
Yeah, look, I think from a system perspective, I think that, you know, it's an evolution. I think that, you know, we can all be comforted that we're starting from a position of strength, but I do think it's a continuation of how we evolve this. I think stress testing is really important. I think the creativity mm-hmm. is an important point. And thinking about things that can, it's not just one event that will occur, but what are the things that can happen together? Spending time on that. And the only thing that you know is the event will be something that you haven't thought of. So I think that we've just got to be prepared for multiple types of things to occur and in different sequences and different timing, and how do we respond to that, not just from a entity perspective, but from a broader system perspective as well.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We are just a bit over time. I guess the key message to leave is that this is a terrific situation for the country. Lots of smart people thinking about the situation, applying the right lens. It's a good issue to have. As you can see from the panel, we're in very capable hands going forward. And AFMA is delighted to sort of help promote this conversation. So please, if I can ask the audience to say thank you to the panel, and straight after this, there's coffee out the back. So thank you for that.